We are on the final tetrad. This is week seven, and we're beginning to look at the Dharma's tetrad. So if you remember, the Anapanasati is divided into 16 stages in four groups of four, and each group is associated with one of the foundations of mindfulness. So we've been looking at a group on body, a group on feelings, a group on mind. Now this one's a group on Dharma's. So Dharma is an incredibly ambiguous word. And it can mean either sort of mental events or mental states, mind objects, or it can mean the teaching of the Buddha in relation to one's experience. And Manjivajra, my preceptor, I think he sort of hit the sort of core meaning. And he said for him, a Dharma is something that the Buddha taught to be true. So in terms of the foundation of mindfulness, you can sort of take it either way, but we're particularly looking at stage 13, which is contemplating impermanence. So it's like bringing to bear one of the Buddha's core teachings, core Dharma teachings, to the Dharmas in the sense of our experience, the elements of our experience as they unfold. So stage 13, contemplating impermanence, I breathe in, contemplating impermanence, I breathe out. So we're still lightly anchored in an awareness of the breath. So that's a sort of light, maybe, I don't know, 20% of our attention or something. And then the rest is kind of this broad awareness of everything else, sensations, feelings, emotions, thoughts. And with that sort of balanced awareness, very open, sort of broad, lightly anchored awareness, we're contemplating impermanence. So here, contemplate doesn't mean think about or reflect on. It means to rest in a direct awareness of a particular experience. So this is bhavana maya pranya, if that phrase means anything to you. So pranya or wisdom is said to have three levels. There's the level of hearing, shrota maya pranya. So on this level, we might read about impermanence or hear about impermanence. And taking that in, we can get to the point of just understanding the concept. So we get to the point where, okay, we've heard about it, we understand the concept. That's shrota maya pranya. Then the next one is chinta maya pranya, which is sort of reflection, level of wisdom. So possibly just on our own, we sort of reflect, turn over, think about. We might do it in a group, discussing, talking about. So this practice gets us to the point of a sort of personal recognition, acceptance, confidence in the teaching. It's like, yeah, I understand the purpose of the concept, and also I've reflected on it, I've got confidence in it. I've sort of related it to my experience. And then thirdly, there's bhavana pranya, which is meditation level of wisdom. And so here, Anapanasati bhavana, so bhavana practice. So this is what we're looking at doing, and this is resting in a direct awareness of our particular experience and kind of recognizing, apprehending the quality of impermanence in it. So awareness has this capacity to directly apprehend experience. So directly apprehend experience and to know it as it is, and just this experience is as it is at the moment. So that's what we're doing. And so if we can do that, we can also kind of recognize the quality of the experience, and it's sort of recognizing the quality of impermanence. So just as we've, throughout the practice, we've been endeavouring to distinguish a concept on the one hand from a direct experience on the other. So initially that the concept of the breath, take that as a pointer, it's pointing you to some particular set of experiences. So in a very similar way, we're sort of taking impermanence as a sort of idea, as a pointer to an aspect or quality of experience. And so we're staying with direct experience, and we're kind of apprehending it as it is, knowing it to be as it is. And, well, part of how it is that it's changing. There's that quality there. And it's very much part of the practice of being with the experience rather than the idea, that we're sort of open to exploring, well, what is the nature of experience? So rather than thinking, oh, it must be impermanent, just think in terms of, look for that quality in there and see if it's there or not. Okay. So we're thinking about experience sort of deals in more abstract qualities. Awareness is revealing very particular things to us. And these particular things are characterized by impermanence, as opposed to abstract concepts, which are characterized by, well, they're very singular, they're very abstract, and they tend to be rather enduring as well. So the idea of breath is the same from one breath to the next, but the actual experience of the body breathing is changing. Yeah. So concepts are singular, abstract, enduring. Actual direct experience is diverse, it's real, and it's changing. So to take one example of a concept, so this is from a quote from Bante, which I haven't quite got the reference at the moment, but he was saying, we might think, in autumn in particular, we might think in terms of a leaf hanging on a tree, changing from green to red to brown. And that's the sort of language you use. And it suggests that there's some sort of a leaf changing, as though a leaf could hang on a tree without being red or green or brown or any other colour. And in fact, well, that's clearly impossible. There isn't actually an enduring leaf with changing characteristics. There's just the colour, there's the texture, there's the shape, there's the weight, there's the form, all of which are changing. So we've got these changing qualities. We haven't got the enduring leaf. So leaf is a concept, and that's characterized by impermanence. That's the idea. It's the same leaf, but it's just a completely different color and shape and so on. So that's an idea or a concept. It's characterized by impermanence, whereas our experience of color, form, texture, shape, weight, well, that's experience, and experience has got this kind of changeable, impermanent quality. So when we're contemplating impermanence in this stage, we're just resting in an awareness of particular experiences. And we may well notice ideas about experience coming up. And I think the best thing to do with those is to take them as pointer and see, okay, well, what's actually there? In that area, in that direction. So if the idea of breath comes up, okay, well, what's the actual experience? What's actually there? Yeah. So I want to talk about three broad concepts which may well be in play in meditation, which are body, self, and womb. So I'll unpack these a bit as I go on. So in a way, body is probably the most familiar one to us. We did the whole first tetrad on the body. And as I was saying there, we've got this label body. And it's basically a pointer to the whole sphere of physical experience. Anything, any tactile experience is going to be an experience of body, because that's where the nerve endings are. And so you can just take this word body as a pointer, and it's pointing towards this whole sphere of tactile experience. And when we look at that, when we follow the direction of that pointer and look at the experience, there's this whole variety of physical sensations covering a range of places, but not actually everywhere. You'll probably find there are gaps. You know, some places there's quite a lot going on, maybe in the palms and the centre of the feet. Other places, at the moment, there doesn't seem to be anything particular happening. And also varying. So the where is varying. They're moving around, and they've got this sort of vibrancy or scintillation to them, a sort of texture. So you can see that sort of vibrancy, that texture, as all in itself a quality that has a sense of momentariness to it. It's like there's just this whole kind of succession of moments of experience. So that's one aspect of impermanence. If you actually look, if you sort of feel right into, and you try it at the moment with perhaps a sensation in your palms, if you sort of feel right into that sensation, there's a sort of tingle to it. And the tingle has a sort of momentariness quality to it. Sort of, it's just a whole kind of succession of moments of experience. Yeah. So we're not experiencing body as a totality. When we look in our experience, what we find is this sort of whole diverse expanse of sensation in certain areas, some of them neutral, others more active. So if we attend to this, we're moving beyond the concept of body as an abstraction, and we're participating more fully in physical sensations as they arise. So that's what our experience actually is. Okay. And it's this that's kind of leading us quite directly into this quality of impermanence. So just finding your way from the idea into the immediate experience, and then there's this quality of flux, there's this quality of momentariness, there's this quality of flow, and just kind of recognising that, really. So that's body, perhaps that's the most straightforward. So the next one's self. So just as with this idea of leaf, there's this idea that there's a leaf and it has a colour and the colour changes. We sort of habitually relate to our own experience like this. It's like, well, there's me and I have these experiences and the experiences change. But when we look for the self that's having these sensations, feelings, emotions, thoughts, my suggestion is when we look for the me that's changing, well, the me that's having this changing experience, what we always come back to is some particular experience. Okay. So when I suggest, my suggestion is when we look, I look for the me, and what I find is some particular experience. And to quote Padmasambhava, one should look into one's mind and see if it's like that or not. It's a great quote. So I'd like to suggest a short exercise, just a few minutes. And the exercise is to do just that, really. So relax into a current experience and look to see if there's anything there that we're particularly identifying with. Is there anything there that seems to be the me that's here now? Okay, so trying to be here now, as I say, and then see if there's anything particular there that's being here now. So let's spend, say, 3 minutes doing that. I'll just ring a bell at the end. Okay. So in a broad sort of way, bringing your awareness into the moment, to the experience that's happening right now. And looking in your experience to see if there's anything there in particular that seems to be the me that's here now. and find one.
I'd quite like to ask something.
Mm.
So whilst there's no sort of fixed and changing sense of self, and it's like that for other people, so there's a sense of connectedness then. So where does the separation come from? A sense of separation?
Where does the sense of separation come from?
Yeah. Okay. So you can see this, that there's nothing fixed or changing, and then you take your awareness out that it's like that for other people as well.
Mm. Mm.
There still ultimately is some kind of separation. I'm over here, you're over there, whatever.
Yeah.
What is
it? So where's that coming from?
I don't know.
Yeah. Mm. I don't know. And perhaps that's something that you're... that perhaps that's where your sense of Catherine is. It's like there's this sense of separation between, you know, this experience that I'm relating to as, you know, as Catherine, as me, and what I'm assuming everybody else is experiencing, which I'm relating to as Paul and Randy Matty and everybody else. Yeah, yeah.
There's a kind of intellectual and an innate, isn't there? So we do this exercise, but we really do it intellectually, but there's something much deeper that gives us that sense of self. It's, you know, it's kind of, it's deep conditioning, isn't it? It's just it's in our subconscious that's keeping us separate. It's when we do an exercise like where's the eye, it's all happening kind of here, isn't it? But the stuff like, if I was just to kind of threat to hit you with an axe, you would soon get that sense of eye, wouldn't you, which comes from deep conditioning, doesn't it?
Possibly. Possibly. Yeah. Certainly in certain circumstances there's a stronger sense of I is worth noticing
that. Yeah.
So what I'm particularly interested at the moment in what came up, you know, in these circumstances at the moment.
Mm.
So for me, for example, it was like, oh well, here am I kind of leading this class, and so I'm kind of noticing the pull towards clocking how many people's here, wondering if someone's gonna turn up at the door, thinking, oh yeah, what's next? You know, that sort of planning sort of side. And I had quite a sense of, this is what I'm doing sort of thing.
Yeah.
So that was more where mine
was. Yeah, I was carrying a kind of bit of disturbance, a little bit of conflict that I picked up on an email actually as I came in, and that was, you know, was that kind of, I was coming up around about that. And
around conflict,
yeah. And just kind of going back to that. So I wasn't actually present in the room. I was, playing stories,
the thoughts and stories, but particularly
emails.
Around conflict. So that's an interesting one to note, actually.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah.
I noticed I've got this feeling here, and I've got this sensation there.
Mm.
And then I notice I've got this thought.
Yeah.
And sometimes I was thinking, where is me? Is there a me? And it's like, well, now they were quite almost random.
Okay. Yeah.
Really.
In
that I think of them as me, my thoughts, my breath, my foot, my...
Yeah.
But actually I was starting to think, well, are they mine? You know, it's just like, it's just an experience. And then
So it sounds like there's this quality of, well, they're just happening.
They're happening.
They're just happening.
These thoughts, they pop in, they go out, quite random. They're not following anything particular.
Yeah.
Like, whereas you obviously had something that triggered off. Mine were just like, almost random.
Yeah. So I think that's, I found that as well, actually, and it's a useful kind of... it's a useful aspect to recognise that, actually this stuff's just happening.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, it doesn't seem so much like it's me, it's just something that's happening.
Yeah.
Because
I then went off on, which has been quite a thing at the moment, about, well, if I stop breathing, where is me?
Uh-huh.
So the breath will stop. So is it really my breath? It's just breath that will stop. And
is this something you've been experimenting with?
Well, I've not been able to get my breath. It's been really sort of... And it's just like, is it my breath? It's just breath.
Yeah.
My body is...
In a way, breath's a very good example, because it, the sort of, well, for me, the opposite of it's just happening is a sense of I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Now, with the breath,
yeah,
it can kind of seem either way, because the breath is quite, the body's quite capable of breathing without our attention at all. And so it's possible to sort of have a relationship of mindfulness with the breath, which doesn't direct and control, which is just allowing it to happen, and then it's just happening. But it's also very possible to sort of kick in a sort of sense of deliberateness, and, you know, and then there's a quality of more deliberate breathing. Well, they have a kind of different quality to them.
Right. It's really interesting, actually, because you think about free divers, they can dive for like 10 minutes, you know, in the water. And the thing that they have to control is the sense of I am breathing, because that's what triggers the need to breathe. But they could show that without that I impacting, I must breathe, they can hold the breath like 10 minutes at a time, which is just astonishing.
Yeah,
you can imagine that. Okay, so there's something about this survival, isn't there, that brings the my breath. That
possibly.
I'm making these statements. There's kind of a question mark on the end of them. But you know, like, is there something about that that
maybe Joy had a bit of that experience with, you know, the the difficulty breathing and that sense of urgency around it. It's something that becomes quite an issue for a number of people in meditation, the control issue. A tendency whenever they sort of bring their attention to something for it to become more deliberate and more sort of directed. And you know, that's something that can happen with the breath. And I think if that is something that is happening with the breath, it's a very, very helpful angle on meditation practice to see if you can let that go. And with the breath, there's so much, it's so apparent that the body is quite capable of breathing without having to do it deliberately, that it's a context in which, I don't know, we can sort of try letting go with confidence that the body is still going to carry on breathing, you know.
I very much was, you know, what you're saying about control, because I often, when I've been practicing, thinking, you know, this, the Anapanasati, and trying to, I immediately try to control. It's almost like immediately I'm focused towards breath, and I will try to control it, and and I don't even. Yeah, sometimes I think, am I controlling it or not controlling it? It almost becomes a...
So there's a desire in there, isn't
it?
Yeah. Or a need.
A need.
To be in control.
Yeah, and I think, am I just watching my breath? Or am? But to me, I'm not just watching it. There is a sense of doing. I am actually changing something. Immediately I try to just focus on the breath. I feel I'm actually changing my breath.
So there's this dynamic that's been running all the way through the Anapanasati, which is of bringing awareness to and then relaxing. And really, you can't let go of something before you've got it fully in awareness.
Okay.
So I think the thing to sort of bring awareness to here is this sort of sense of need to be in control. And really, the first valid first stage is just to bring awareness to, you know, before you even think about trying to relax out of, you just bring awareness to. And that's probably where a lot of the identity's going, you know, for yourself. It's like, oh yeah, this whole thing about controlling, the need for control, that's probably where there's quite a lot of joy.
That makes sense.
I have exactly the same with breath. As soon as they focus on it, it feels like then I am controlling it. I haven't managed to let go at all. But something Diyajoti said was that the in-breath takes a little bit more effort than the out-breath. And that made me think, oh, well, maybe I'm just observing effort, and if that feels like control, I'm just try and get used to that. I don't know, because it's always going to seem like something's happening, particularly on the in-breath.
But the thing is, if you if you just don't make that effort, then the body will do it after a while anyway.
That's what I mean, the body makes more effort to do it. I don't know whether it's just going to take lots of time to get to a point where it feels like you're not making...
Well, I think the breath's a really good sort of area to sort of experiment with this, to work with this, because it is so clear that actually I'm going to carry on breathing without doing it deliberately. And as I said to Joy, I think the very much the first step is to kind of bring awareness to this tendency to control, and perhaps it's a need to control. Or a desire to control.
Does having more of the breath perhaps help? You know, because rather than being too focused in on the breath, because sometimes I wonder if I'm there's too much focus on the breath and I need to actually have to let go a bit of that, perhaps, like you were saying about later on, especially is only like 20% on the breath and the rest is on something else. Broad, so I just wonder if that's I get too focused in on the breath.
It might be. I mean, I can see the whole dynamic around the tendency to control could very well go with a sort of emphasis on focus and perhaps a sort of narrowing onto it.
Yeah, maybe just widening that out. I mean, I do try to do that.
Yeah. And this quality you were mentioning earlier about, well, it's just happening.
Yeah.
That has a certain open spaciousness to it.
It does, and it did feel much more open. I wasn't focused on the breath, you see, so much. Yeah. I was actually just watching what else was happening. So I was watching, where did I feel things in my feet, my hands, and then a thought popped in, and then was my breath, and then there was something in my foot. And
so it might be that... For you, a way into this sort of more spacious awareness is to see if you can get that sense of, oh, it's just happening.
Right.
With whatever it is that you're kind of feel you're controlling, that you feel you're kind of narrowed in on, a bit over focused on. Yeah.
Thank you, that's helpful.
Mm. Okay. So there's a lot going on here, and perhaps there's a sense that. It's a sort of process. You can think of it as like we have a sense of self which is continually in process of construction. And we're constructing it, at least in part, by identifying with certain parts of our experience. Or relationships to our experience or something. So. And that, as a process, that's something that's going on. Recognising that is contemplating impermanence. So it's worth kind of noticing and contemplating as such. And also, if we can do that, then what we're doing is we're kind of identifying it with it less. I think the more we bring something into awareness, the less we tend to identify with it. And the more it becomes something that's just happening. Yeah. So one way to sort of pick up a sense of, well, how much or whether I'm identifying with something is to take an example of anxiety. So, okay, so this recognising this anxiety there. And I might relate to that in terms of, well, I'm feeling anxious. And there's a sense of, well, does that fit? Does that resonate with my experience? I'm feeling anxious. Or... I could put it another way and say, oh, I'm aware of a feeling of anxiety there. And does that fit? So one of the two is probably going to be more kind of resonant. It's going to kind of fit better. So that I'm not saying that one of the two is more true in an objective sense. I'm just saying one of those two is going to feel more resonant with our experience. So it may well be that actually, no, it's me, I'm anxious. It's not this an anxiety in my awareness, it's me. there may be quite a distinct sense of, no, that's the one that fits, it's me. And that's fine, that's just something to recognise. So that's identification happening. Yeah. But we may also find that it's possible to sort of make that move from I'm feeling anxious to I'm aware of anxiety in my experience. And in fact, that's kind of one of the first approaches we learn to working with hindrance. It's pretty much in the area of skylight mind. You've got this visual metaphor of this open blue sky, and then within it there's this cloud, which is a particular hindrance that's going on. But the sky itself isn't the cloud, it's spacious, it's containing, it's in itself sort of clear and open and light. So we may well find that we're able to make that move. And so noticing, if we can, that the identification, to an extent at least, is quite optional. It can move. It can move from identifying with something to identifying with something else or not identifying with it. And it's a curious transition to make, because in a certain way, nothing else has changed in our experience. Yeah. There's still the anxiety there, but I've shifted from the it's me to, oh, I'm aware of it. So there's a certain sort of freedom of movement there. And I think for myself, perhaps one of the first things I got from meditation was this sense, I still had a very sort of established sense of me doing the practice, but I had this sense of I'm not stuck, you know, I'm not stuck in a mental state. I can work with it, and it can change. Okay, so that sense of freedom of movement there. So that's a useful shift, a shift from I'm anxious to I'm aware of anxiety in that experience. So I'll say a little bit more about that later on, because in a way that's just the first step, and there's a couple more steps that we can take. But before I do that, I want to say a little bit also about implicit self-referencing. So far we've been looking at some more explicit, perhaps. But there's a sort of implicit self-reference in likes and dislikes, in wanting and not wanting. So it's easy for the mind to kind of slip from an initial... Okay, some of these experiences are pleasant, some of them are unpleasant, which in itself is not identified at all. It's just the feeling quality, feeling tone of experience. It's easy to slip from that to, oh, I like these, I like this, I don't like that, you know, don't like that ache, oh, I like this kind of pleasant sensation. And then from there to wanting and not wanting. You know, it's like, I want more of this, I don't want that, you know. Yeah, I really wish that would stop. So there's a slide there from pleasant, unpleasant, to liking, not liking, to wanting, not wanting. And you can see that sort of, it's a slide into more and more kind of a sense of me involved. So this is sort of more implicit self-reference. And there's also a way in which my sense of self can kind of underlie hindrances. So I want to sort of bring in an anecdote at this point. So a few years ago I was on retreat, and I was just walking through a conversation that was going on in the lounge, and someone dropped in a question. They said, oh, Pranyamati, what's the sixth fetter? So it's a particular list of 10 with the Buddha taught. We usually focus on the first three, and she was asking, so what's number six? And I said, oh, I think it's this. And she immediately said, no, that's wrong. And I suddenly got quite annoyed. And it turned out, in fact, that she was quite right. I was completely wrong. It wasn't that at all. Which was quite helpful, really, because it's easy for that annoyance to slip into a sort of self-righteousness, which can... attached to being right, you know, and in this case I wasn't right, so it couldn't. So that was helpful. But I sort of realised that I got annoyed because I really don't like being contradicted in public. And then I realised that, where's that coming from? It's like, and I recognised that, well, when I was young, imperative was always to sort of kind of know, to get the grades, to be successful, to know what I'm talking about. And then as I sort of grow older, there's this sort of resting on the laurels of experience and being the person that knows. And, you know, and so there's quite a bit of insecurity in being wrong, you know, and not knowing and being ignorant and foolish and so on. And yeah, particularly in public, being shown up in that sort of way. So there's a sort of self-view under there, or a need that's kind of triggering the hindrance, you know, because it would have been quite possible to sort of just respond with a, oh, right, I was wrong, what is it then?
Or I don't know.
Or I don't know, I've got no idea.
Yeah. Thanks.
It's a great answer. Seriously. Yeah. No idea.
It would have been a more truthful answer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so that's sort of the way in which a self-view can kind of underlie a hindrance. Yeah. So self-referencing, happening all the time, in the sense that it's a process that part of our mind's preoccupied with. And it's in the area of sanya. So those of you familiar with the five skandhas, one of them is sanya, which is often translated as perception, but it's to perceive something as something. You know. So it often involves an underlying view. And identifying is just very much part of the activity of sanya. It is very useful to become aware of it as something that's going on and as a process that's going on. So there's a fluidity, a malleability to it as a process. Yeah. And in relation to meditation, it's very easy for the sort of self-view as a good meditator or a bad meditator to sort of kick in. So perhaps I'm sitting there in meditation and some pleasant experience arises. It's quite a blissful experience. And then it's easy to go from that to a sense of, oh, I'm experiencing bliss, I'm experiencing sukha. And then from that to, oh, I'm the sort of person that experiences bliss in meditation. This is great. And then from there to, I must be a really good meditator. I'm the sort of guy who could sit down and really bliss out in meditation. I must be really good at this. So there's more and more self-view kicking in. And the opposite can also happen as well. It's like something unpleasant happening in meditation. Here's meditation, I'm trying to concentrate, I'm getting distracted, I'm finding that unpleasant. So there's this sense of, well, there's already this sense of, I'm trying to concentrate, I'm feeling distracted, I'm finding that unpleasant. And then I'm the sort of person that just gets really distracted whenever I meditate to, I must be really crap at this. I'm just no good at this meditation. Never was any good. Never will be. So there's this sort of slide into, from what's initially just an experience that's happening into a lot of self-view. Yeah. And as Joy said, if you can just experience that as something that's happening, then there's a lot more flexibility and less of a problem around it. Yeah.
I sometimes laugh when I get that.
Yeah.
I get
that slide into.
Oh, I'm totally useless.
I'm great. Or rubbish. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm bothering. You know. I find that if I actually go, oh, there's that one again. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, this is familiar.
Yeah.
And actually, this is what meditation's about. So.
Yeah, this is just what happens.
Just
in
let
meditation.
It go. Yeah, I found that having that sort of lightness towards myself,
yeah,
that identity has really helped.
Yeah,
can't always do it, but when I can, it's like, oh.
Yeah. So there's that sort of lightness, not taking ourselves too seriously.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And I think that is very characteristic of, you know, the people who've got somewhere in meditation. So if I think of my meditation teachers, Prakasha and Basantra in particular, others as well, Tejananda as well, I think, you know, they've got a pretty, they don't take themselves too seriously, yeah, they're fairly relaxed around that. And that's, yeah, I think that's quite characteristic. Yeah. So, just to finish off in this area of self, I want to sort of indicate, point to a couple of ways of taking it further. And because it's useful to kind of recognise that there are more steps to take. So if we've kind of got a certain familiarity, we're taking this first step from, I'm such and such, you know, I'm annoyed, I'm distracted, to, oh, I'm aware of annoyance in my experience. Then it's sort of easy to think that's it. You know, particularly if it's a really helpful sort of step to have taken, we find out, oh, this really frees me up. Then we can think, oh, well, that's it, that's what meditation's about. And actually, well, it's the first step, it's a very valuable first step. And what we've done is we've made that move from identifying with a particular experience to identifying with awareness. So that's helpful. So the next step would be to let go of that identification with awareness, and then awareness is just something that's happening. So that's quite a good sort of reflection to bring in to do this. So if you find, okay, I'm able to just be with my experience in this sort of natural, empathic, human way of being present with experience, is it possible to just kind of recognize this as something that's just happening? Okay, so I'm aware there is awareness, there is experience, it's just happening. Yeah. This quality of awareness, is it me, or is it just something that's happening? And so that might get us to a point of, well, there's just experience in awareness. And perhaps it's got a quality of awareness as this sort of container for experience. So it's sort of, perhaps there's a sort of spacious quality to awareness, and there's particular experience. Maybe there's a big open blue sky and there's big clouds. It's just awareness and experience is just happening.
Can I just say?
Yeah.
So I was sitting after I stopped conceptualising this, that and the other, I had a sense of just awareness, and I you know, noticing sensation in different parts of the body. Yeah. But then I was thinking, well, how am I deciding where I'm going to notice sensation? Do you see what I mean? So it was almost like my awareness was moving my attention around or something, and then I was thinking, okay, well, who's doing that? I mean, I'm doing what?
Right. Okay. So, was that, yeah, a sort of sense of puzzlement about?
Yeah, because it was, you know, so I'd be aware if there's something around, you know, coldness around the toe or something, and then a sense of sensation where the breath was going in and out of the body. But I was thinking, well, who's deciding what I'll notice? You know, where my
awareness
is going. Yeah.
That's a good question. Mm. Who's deciding where my attention goes?
Yeah.
So perhaps that's another aspect of experience that is very easy to identify with. It's like, my attention moves from one thing to another. I've already said my, haven't I? Attention moves from one thing to another.
Yeah.
And then there's this question, well, who's deciding how that, you know, moves from one thing to another? And it's very easy to identify with, you know, I'm the person that's deciding to move my attention from this to that.
Yeah.
And there's identification, you know. But perhaps from what you were saying, there's more of a sense of, well, actually, my experience was that attention moves from this to that to that.
So this is the point you're at of just
it's just happening,
right?
Yeah,
it's just happening. Yeah, so I don't even need to investigate that, really. Just sort of there is. Yeah.
Well, contemplate is the suggestion.
Contemplate.
Perhaps rather than investigate.
Yeah.
So yeah.
It's not active.
Yeah. And contemplate's got a quality of noticing. So my attention's moving from this to that to that. Oh, I'm really wondering who's moving it. So, oh, that's a bit of identification going on.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I notice as I get older is waking up in the morning and not knowing who I am, and there's a space. And I was saying it now to explain it, but just holding that space, holding at bay the I coming in. So just literally waking up, and there is awareness, and there isn't any knowing. Mm-hmm. And aware that you're right at the edges, that any moment now the I is going to come in, and I go, oh, yeah, I'm laid in bed, and it's Monday, and I'm going to do this. I just think it's such a powerful space to be in.
Oh yeah.
So it is just no subjectivity in the experiences. Does that make sense?
Mm. Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you get that?
I've had it sometimes. Yeah. You can get it at the moment where you're almost asleep as well.
Yeah.
Where there's almost a loss of the lack. Yeah.
It's a beautiful space.
Is, isn't it?
But then once you say it's a beautiful space, you go, oh, yeah, I'm just having a night. Right. Your sublime experience of whatever that I'm having now, and then it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful space sounds quite unidentified. It's a beautiful experience that I'm having.
Yeah, and then it comes in stronger and stronger, yeah.
Yeah. And it can move the other way, you know, as we sort of settle in meditation, we can sort of let go of identifying with the hindrance into identifying with awareness, and then see if you can let go of that into, well, it's just happening. Attention's moving, awareness is happening, there's experience in awareness. There's a sense, perhaps, of a container. A container. And then I remember Vasantra dropping in a suggestion at one point. See if you can let go of the idea of awareness as a container of experience. Because it is an idea. And so we have this kind of spatial metaphor. And in certain ways, it limits us. So to take an example, Shinandi was describing recently how... sometimes she has this, in relation to metta, sometimes she has this sense of real closeness and intimacy and being with in a very tender and intimate way. And sometimes she has this sense of very open spaciousness. And both of which are very valuable, positive experiences, but she had this sense of, well, it's not possible to be both. There's a sort of spatial sense of, well, either I'm distant or I'm close. Yeah. And Vijayamaya was sort of challenging that and saying, well, is that actually the case in your experience, that it's not possible to be both in this sense of freedom and openness and spaciousness and with the quality of tenderness and intimacy and closeness? And she realised that actually it was just an idea. That the space was just an idea, and it is possible to be both, and that her sense of sort of infiniteness, so which initially was with this sort of open spatial freedom of movement, became a sort of infinite availability or an infinite responsiveness or an infinite connection, that sort of thing. So, yeah, so whilst it can be very helpful to have a sort of sense of spaciousness, and whilst it can be very helpful, in the end it's an idea which will at some level limit us. So see if it's possible to let go of that, was Vasantra's suggestion. So I thought I'd just drop those in, not so much by way of suggesting you necessarily try that today, but it's useful to kind of recognise that the steps we're taking in meditation, they're just steps along the way. There's another step beyond that. There's another step beyond that. Yeah.
What was the Sandra said? See if you can
let go of the idea of
attention.
The idea of awareness as a container for experience.
Right, awareness.
Yeah. So how are we doing? I've got one more area to talk about. I've got a feeling it's been quite full already. So we could leave that for later and try doing a bit of meditation, or we could carry on. Yeah, you're up, carry on.
I'm up for carrying
on. So the last one, so Prakash's suggestion is the other view in play is room. So room is basically that part of the world which we're aware of in meditation. So Buddhism often talks in terms of the way in which we divide our experience into self and world. But we don't often bring the label world into play. The world is a bit abstract, it's a bit too big really. There's a part of the world which is the bit that we're kind of aware of at the moment, and that's, you know, shrine room. So if we're in meditation, here we are in a shrine room. We've got a sense of shrine room, which is probably more live than our sense of the world out there. So that's why we're talking about room at the moment. But it does tie into this basic activity of mind, which is sanya, which is dividing our experience up into, oh, this bit's me and that bit's not me. So this is me and this is the room I'm in. You know, so room is the bit of experience that's not me. Now, we're all living in this era which is very dominated by an underlying view of materialism, scientific materialism. So there's this generally unquestioned assumption that there's an objective reality out there that we're looking at. But actually that's not our immediate experience. So what we're experiencing are sights, sounds, touches, tastes, smells. So all of these are sense impressions. So they're all impressions in awareness. So to take visual, perhaps I associate that with world much more. So I've got my eyes open and I'm seeing all this stuff. And the default assumption is, well, this is the room I'm in, you know, and it's an objective out there thing. But actually what I'm experiencing are visual impressions. And what I think is helpful is sort of put to one side the whole question about objective reality and just kind of recognise that actually these are visual impressions. Yeah. So what I'm experiencing at the moment are visual impressions. And whether or not they're visual impressions of an objectively, independently existing room, putting that question to one side, I can recognise that whether or not that's the case, it's clearly the case that I'm experiencing visual impressions. Yeah. I think that's all we need to do, really. I think the whole question about is there a world out there or not is not really one that we need to worry about. What we're doing in meditation is we're kind of bringing our attention to a direct experience rather than a concept. Okay, so in mindfulness and breathing, we're bringing our awareness to a direct experience of the breath rather than to an idea or a concept of the breath. So that involves recognising the difference between a direct experience and an idea. So my suggestion is the whole objective world out there is an idea. It's a concept. And our experience is visual sense impressions, sound impressions, touch, tactile impressions, tastes, smells. That's our experience. Okay. So one further observation around visual impressions. So I'm a bit short-sighted. So what I'm seeing, and my eyes are open, what I'm seeing is a somewhat blurred visual impression. Now, I don't assume that the room I'm looking at is blurred, even though that's what I'm seeing. So I'm sort of dividing up this sense impression into the bit that I think of as me, which is the sort of blurriness, and the bit that I think of the room, which I'm assuming is completely sharp in focus. And that's, well, that's part of the activity of mind. It's like, oh, this bit's me, that bit's the world. Yeah. So most of the time so far, we've been relating to stuff that's more kind of on the me side, you know, body, self, awareness, attention, feelings. So here we're coming to the stuff that we tend to associate as the not me, you know, as the world out there. And the suggestion is that we bring exactly the same approach to it. We're sort of recognising the difference between, oh, this is an idea and this is an experience. And ideas are liable to kind of be there, to be in play. They may not be explicit thoughts, so it may just be underlying views like, oh, that's the world out there. And the suggestion is, you know, when an idea or a view, a label kind of comes into play, just take it as a pointer and look, okay, so what's there in my experience? So just as we did with body, I think perhaps it's easier to do with body. We've got this idea, body, okay, what's there in my immediate experience that relates to that idea, body? Okay. So we've got this idea, the room I'm in, so what's there in my immediate experience, my direct experience that relates to that idea, the room I'm in, well, all of this sort of visual impression. And there may be other sense impressions as well. For example, I'm getting a light sort of sense of the touch of air, a sort of sense of movement of air, which gives me a sense of space, you know, a sense I'm in a space with a, perhaps even a bit of a draft, the door's opening and shining. So there's a sense of world out there from that. And it's pointing to these aspects of my experience. Most of what's in vision, certain amount of what's in touch. Anything else, yeah. Sound, very often, you know, cars going down Gloucester Road. It's all kind of not me. So that's the suggestion of what we're doing, contemplating impermanence. We're coming back to our immediate experience and kind of noticing the quality of immediate experience as in itself changing. Yeah. And you may well find that there's a view that comes in of, yeah, it was just a bit sort of me that's changing like that. Okay, I move my head and the visual experience changes. But the room's not changing. okay, so that may well be a thought that comes to mind, a view that comes to mind, just kind of recognising, oh yeah, that's a view that's coming to mind. But my experience is, I think what it is, it's sort of fluid, changing. And also kind of recognising, well, that's actually characteristic of ideas and concepts. They're characteristically singular, static, what was the other one I said? Abstract, yeah. Whereas experience is characteristically diverse, real, fluid, changing. Yeah. So what we're not suggesting is thinking about impermanence. So we might, for example, contemplate the impermanence of the room, say I'm in a shrine room, and notice that the ceiling above the shrine is a bit blackened. You know. So as we burn candles and burn incense, lots of smoke, ceiling getting blackened, you think, oh yeah, so I've got this concept of room, and I've got this concept of the room's changing because, you know, the ceiling's gradually getting blackened. But perhaps certain qualities of experience we associate with change. So if we notice, like, there's a crack in the wall, yeah, or we notice, like, there's a blackening of the paint, or we notice some things we notice which we associate with change. So that's a sort of thinking about impermanence. We've got this idea of the room, and we've got this idea about the way in which the room is changing. But they're going to be processes that we're probably not going to be able to see happening. You know, I can't see the paint on the ceiling gradually getting darker. You know, it's not happening fast enough. I can't see the crack gradually widening. It's not happening fast enough. So that's a sort of reflection on impermanence, but it's not the sort of contemplation practice that we're suggesting we do just now. So to unpack that a bit more, there's Prakash was saying, well, there's two basic ways of contemplating transitoriness of sensation. So the first way, which is not so helpful, is to think about it. And so we've got the label impermanent, and we're applying that to the idea. So, for example, the idea of breath. So we might think, oh yeah, here I am, breathing in. Yep, now that's stopped. Okay, now I'm breathing out. Okay, now that's stopped. So all that was impermanent. Oh, here I am, breathing in again. Yeah. Okay.
I recognise that.
So that's the sort of thinking about. So it's
yeah.
Bringing the thought impermanence to bear with the thought breath. So that's not so helpful. That more helpful approach is to follow the direct physical experience of the body breathing. This directly informs us of its quality of impermanence, of transitoriness, of change, without labelling it. And then we can kind of participate in the breath as a breathing being. So that's it, really. Yeah. So what I suggest is, it's quite a longer talk, but I thought we could have a shorter, more led practice, and then a tea break, and then a somewhat longer, unled practice where I just drop in the Anapanasati instructions.
Good, a bit of garbage.